Friday, March 7th, 2380. Sanar, Seleucia, Riverside District, east of Queen Sheva Park. The android designated 33S GRP-HN1, and known to much of the galaxy, at least for the last few minutes, as the Butcher of Musashi, was running with a purpose, putting his superhuman physique to good use despite the hobbling injury to his right thigh. With their surface vehicle destroyed and their spacecraft too big to maneuver in a built-up area, the people chasing him had no chance of catching up. He could, with a little luck and a little determination, reach the Queen's Palace, which stood on a hill at the corner of the city, before them. And if Her Majesty were at home, why then they could all have some fun. The only thing that stood between him and his goal now was the bridge over the River Seine, a delicate high arch of duracrete and tritanium that carried only traffic bound for the palace. Sure, there were guards at the palace gates, a quarter mile or so beyond the bridge, but so what? There were other approaches once he was across the river. He hadn't been rigorously drilled and had part of his programming altered for this mission for nothing. Several blocks back and losing ground, Benjamin Hutchins, the man whom GRP-HN1 was designed to look like for purposes of framing him for an infamous crime in the year 2288, toggled a map overlay onto the tracking mode display of the old-fashioned Starfleet tricorder he'd borrowed from Spock, and cursed. Still running, he dragged out his communicator, flipped it open, and hailed his ship. "Here, Captain," replied Lieutenant Commander Maximilian Hunter, whom he'd left in command. "The Butcher, the other me, is headed for the Palace Bridge," said Griffin, only slightly out of breath. "None of us will catch him in time. It's up to you guys to stop him."
"How?"
"Use your initiative, Mr. Hunter. Just don't let him cross that bridge, and try not to vaporize him. I need him alive. Hutchins out."
Putting the communicator away, he bent to the task of pouring on more speed.
"Unknown Predator-class vessel, you are in violation—"
"Shut off that damn noise," Hunter snapped irritably, and the crewman filling in for the absent Lieutenant Leeds cut off the hail.
"Gang, we've been tasked with stopping a man from crossing a bridge without vaporizing him. Ideas?"
The fill-in comm officer said, "Destroy the bridge before he gets there?" Hunter grinned.
"I like the way you think, Tarolo."
Punching commands into the helm, he took the surprise out of hover mode, winged over, and made for the river.
"Here we go."
Point of order, Lieutenant Commander Hunter," said the navigator, Rick Sterling, while checking with Seleucia's GPS network to make sure they were heading for the right bridge.
"Proceed, Lieutenant Commander Sterling," Hunter replied mock formally.
"The only weapon we have that can reliably take out a bridge will waste half the city and probably sink us," Sterling pointed out. Hunter's antennae flexed thoughtfully.
"Good point. Let's see if Lieutenant Finney has any suggestions."
"Finney," the surprise's security officer answered, halting by the riverbank several blocks downstream of the bridge and watching the surprise swoop past overhead as she did so.
"Jamie, Max, listen, we need to blow that bridge. How can we do it without incinerating most of the city?"
Jamie thought about it for about half a second, and then demonstrated the mastery of her craft that had made her the Invincible's armory officer for 2 5-year missions running.
"Have Hank pull the antimatter bottle from torpedo number one. The cascading explosives by themselves should do the job nicely."
"Great. Thanks. Max out."
"Target locked," Sterling reported, head bowed over the navigation station's backup weapon controls. "Our man is 500 meters from beginning to cross."
"Hank,"
Hunter called down through the open emergency floor hatch leading into the ship's torpedo bay.
2 seconds,
Henry Lang's voice called back. A moment later, there was the whir and clunk of the ship's single torpedo tube loading and locking.
"Torpedo ready!"
"Fire!"
Max cried.
"Torpedo away!"
Rick replied. For a second, both HN1, as he sprinted toward the bridge, and the crew of the Surprise themselves wondered whether they had just made a terrible mistake, for when the doctored torpedo emerged from the tube, it looked just like they always did. Putting on the brakes, HN1 saw the torpedo and its orange corona of light, so distinct as the stress of the moment dilated time that he imagined he could see the markings on its casing, just as it struck the side of the bridge's main arch. Then it exploded.
Not with a sudden, annihilating flash of antimatter, a bigger, more brutal blast than any nuclear weapon could ever have produced, but in a most impressive fireball in its own right, one that obliterated the center span of the bridge entirely and sent the wreckage of both ends, sheared off at the piers, plunging into the gorge. The blast raced up the Kingsway, blowing HN1 off his feet and sending him tumbling back nearly a block. But if it had been an armed photon torpedo warhead, he and most of the Riverside District would have been vaporized instantly. The butcher picked himself up, stared in disbelief at the ruins of the bridge, shook his fist at the surprise as she raced away, with a pair of Crown City Defense Command interceptors hot on her tail, and cursed roundly. Then he turned and darted into an alley, hoping to lose his pursuers in the tangled back streets of Riverside. Aery Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Exile, Manhunt, Part 6, Must Converge. For weeks, since before Gil Grissom went to Zawin, the Crown City Constabulary and the RSMP both had been encouraging people to keep their children inside, thanks to the work of the killer the press was quick to dub the Sanar Ripper. Whoever he was, he'd murdered at least 7 children in the past 5 weeks, catching them unawares in alleys and back streets, in one case in broad daylight, but usually at night. The toll would have been higher, the authorities believed, if it weren't winter, when the city's young would be more likely to be inside after dark anyway, just because of the cold and the snow. But there were those children with no people to keep them inside, and no inside to keep in. Sarah Seidel was 18. Being Seleucian, that meant she was not yet quite beginning adolescence, and had always been considered an unusually serious child. She'd been thought so by her teachers and her peers even before the terrifying evening 3 years before, when her father went berserk and her mother killed him. Since that time, her dark-eyed seriousness had quite transcended her age, causing her to be labeled withdrawn, sullen, even borderline autistic, by the succession of foster parents into whose hands her mother's imprisonment had placed her. The most recent set, pompous and unpleasant people by Sarah's admittedly rather exacting standards, had gone so far as to suggest to the family services caseworker that there might be, how can we put this delicately, something wrong with her mind. There was nothing wrong with Sarah's mind. It was her heart that was broken. Unwilling to accept that her mother should go to prison for what was to Sarah no crime, and yet inevitably affected by her father's death, she found herself unable to form any kind of attachment to the rotating series of usually well-meaning strangers into whose far-flung homes she was thrust. When the Palachians had made that outrageous suggestion to the caseworker, thinking Sarah was upstairs and wouldn't hear them, that was the last straw. She'd left that day, quitted the grimy Kumbari port city of Quivex for good, and returned as a stowaway on a freighter to what she felt was the only home she had left. Sanar was cold, but Sanar was clean, and Sanar was her town. She was comfortable there. For more than a year now, she'd survived on its streets and byways, living by her wits and the judicious exercise of her considerable intellect, with a considerable dash of the kindness of others. It might be cold, and it might be dark, but Sarah Seidel was not afraid of the dark, and she had acquired plenty of blankets and clothes against the cold. The snow was no big deal, either. It couldn't get past the piece of thermoplastic that Mr. Gates, who ran the checkout counter at the Kingsway branch of the Crown City Public Library on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and sometimes let her sleep in the stacks when the weather was particularly foul, had given her. Mr. Gates was a sweet old man. He let her take books out, even though she didn't have a library card, and he split his lunch with her when he was working and she came in. As for the killer, well, Sarah wasn't afraid of him, either. An officer off some Federation ship had misplaced his Type 1 phaser in the market square the previous summer, and by good fortune and industry it had come into Sarah's hands. Though battered and scarred by the hard treatment it had undergone before Sarah got hold of it, the phaser still had a bit of energy in it, and, thanks to the internet and the public terminals at the library, she knew very well how to use it. At the moment, Sarah was huddled in her blankets, under the thermoplastic, tucked into the angle of a right-angle corner, where one of the buildings flanking her alley near the library was a few feet wider than the one abutting it from behind. The other two sides of her little space were cloaked by a simple but effective windbreak and tent flap, built from pieces of shipping crates and a 3-foot length of concrete reinforcing bar she'd scrounged from a construction site. She was reading her latest library acquisition, A. Petrarca's Elementary Wedge Physics for the Inquisitive by the light of the small battery lantern some fool had thrown away a while ago. If you had a phaser, some wire, and a little tape, you didn't need a CE dry battery to make a lantern work. Such a minuscule drain was no great hardship to the cerium crellide cell in even the smallest phaser. Sarah found the book so engrossing that she'd completely tuned out not only the cold, but also the strange noises drifting into the alley from Queen Shiva Park, just a couple of blocks away. She had just gotten to the part about time dilation and hyperintelligence theory when someone suddenly yanked the flap of her shelter open and thrust his head and shoulders inside. She recoiled, more surprised than afraid, and dropped the book as the intruder, a young Cheltari man, maybe in his early 40s, gave her a cheerful leer and forced his way inside a bit further. "Good evening," he said in a bizarrely normal tone of voice, given what he was doing. "We're going to have a nice time together, you and I." Sarah hadn't been a child overly given to panic even before she started her odyssey of foster homes and vagrancy. That odyssey had effectively erased any lingering tendency toward the vapors she might have had. Rather than scream or backpedal uselessly against the concrete wall behind her, she snatched up her phaser, killing the light as the makeshift leads parted, and plunged into the alley through the side curtain of her shelter. Sturdy of spirit or not, she was still a pre-adolescent child, and she couldn't suppress the shriek of dismay that welled up in her instinctively when the stranger's hand closed around her ankle and dragged her back. She knew the phaser would be useless, would refuse to fire, until she closed the casing where she'd had to pry it apart to run the leads for the lantern, but she needed both hands to do that, and right now the one that wasn't maintaining a death grip on the weapon was busy scrabbling for purchase on the snowy tarmac of the alley in an effort to keep from being pulled back clean into the shelter. Off in the distance there was a deep reverberating boom, followed by the sound of rending metal and falling concrete, as if a building had been blown up. Sarah heard her attacker say, "What the?" and for a moment his grip on her leg loosened. She tried to get loose, but that seemed only to recall the man to his task. He reaffirmed his grip and started dragging her more violently backward, eager to be done with his work and gone before the authorities descended on the district to investigate that explosion. A second later, after a final sharp tug, his hand was gone from her ankle, and Sarah heard the intruder produce a startled cry of his own. Throwing herself forward, she crawled the rest of the way clear, rolled onto her back, and looked up in horror to see another man, this one apparently human, stocky and dressed mostly in gray, holding her would-be attacker clean off the ground by his neck. "Who the fuck are you?" the young Seleucian demanded, his voice cracking with fear. "Ease off! I've got no quarrel with—" Sarah had read a book once about the myths of old Earth. She had never met an Earthman, but she found them intriguing, if only because her monarch had such an evident fondness for them. And she knew what a vampire was. She hadn't thought they were real, though, until she saw the man in gray tear her erstwhile attacker's throat open with his teeth and drain his blood in great, sucking gasps. She found this so terrifyingly transfixing, she forgot all about repairing her weapon. She just lay there, eyes huge and white-rimmed in the gloom, and watched the Sanar Ripper die. HN1 threw the limp carcass carelessly down onto the sheet of thermoplastic, knocking the props from under it and causing the whole bodged structure to collapse with a crash, wiped his mouth on the back of one sleeve, and smacked his lips. "Ah, I needed that." His eyes lit on the figure, heavily bundled in mismatched and ragged clothes, but still unmistakably juvenile, sprawled on the ground next to the remains of the shelter, and his face, which would probably have been reasonably handsome for an Earthman's if it hadn't been smeared with blood, lifted into light. "Hello," he said happily. "Dessert." He took a step toward her. Sarah scrambled back, remembering the phaser, but her hands were clumsy with fear. This apparition frightened her far more than the Ripper had, and wouldn't obey her simple instructions. The phaser rattled uselessly, its casing refusing to lock together. "Come here, morsel," said HN1 mockingly. "I'll make it easier for you than I did for that cretin." He smiled, baring unnaturally pointed teeth, for human anyway. "I promise." Click. Whine. Yellow light. Sarah raised the phaser and pressed the firing plate. Badly damaged and mostly depleted, the weapon spat only a single pulse, a small disk of blue-white energy before fizzling out, but Sarah's aim was good. The discharge struck the butcher, in the left eye and blew the synthetic flesh off the entire upper left quarter of his face. Screaming, he reeled, clapping a hand to the smoking injury. Then, when no second shot was forthcoming, he steadied himself with a snarl that was more anger and pain. Lowering his hand, he revealed that the duralloy skull beneath the fake skin was still intact, though the optic that had lain beneath his false left eye was a sparking ruin now.
"You'll have to do better than that, my little digestif," he remarked, smiling horribly.
Sarah drew breath to scream, really scream, the way she pretty much never did. But before she could, the sound of another voice. Actually, the part of her mind that remained forever analytical noted, it was more or less the same voice, bellowed with wordless rage from the narrow end of the alley behind her. A moment later, that voice's owner bounded by, leaping clean over the prostrate child, and plowed into HN1's midsection in a furious flying tackle. Both men tumbled end for end in a tangled mass of brown coat and gray tunic, separating at the widest point of the alley and coming up facing each other. The man in brown still had his back to Sarah, and she could see that he was not terribly tall, but very broad-shouldered, much like the vampire. A moment later, she felt a hand on her shoulder. Flinching, she made to duck away, but the defective streetlight that sometimes shone down from the corner above her shelter, and sometimes did not, chose that moment to click on, and she saw that the person who had touched her was not still another attacker. He was a policeman, a kindly-faced Cheltari in the brass-buttoned green jacket, polished cross-belt, and brown campaign hat of a Royal Seleucian Mountie. Sarah had an ingrained distrust of police after the experiences of the last few years, but she had always had a special place in her heart for the Mounties, and at the sight of him she felt so profoundly rescued that she let herself become the child she really was again and threw her arms around her, burying her face in the rough surge of his chest. "It's all right," he said, his voice low and so soothing she could almost have passed out from relief. "You're safe now. I won't let anyone hurt you." Rising, he drew her up with him and led her gently away from the violence-filled alley, out to the street, where a small group of people, most of them, Sarah still possessed enough wit to notice with surprise, wearing Starfleet uniforms, waited. Placing her with them, Gil Grissom knelt down to look her in the face. Not such a task, she was tall for her age, and smoothed her dark, disordered hair. "You stay here. These people are friends. They'll look after you. All right?" She didn't want him to leave, the first person who'd shown her kindness in the last tumultuous few minutes, but she knew he was a Mountie, and they always had work to do. Summoning her tattered self-possession, she nodded and said in a barely audible voice, "Okay." Grissom patted her shoulder, stood up, and said to the Starfleet officer he'd placed her in front of, "Take care of her." "I shall do so, Inspector." The man, tall, thin, with the most wonderfully deep voice, replied, and Grissom turned and hurried back into the alley. Sarah looked up at her newly designated protector with wide, solemn eyes, her composure rapidly returning. She had initially taken him for a human, but he had pointed ears and sharply upswept eyebrows, and with a little thrill she realized what he must be.
"Are you a Vulcan?"
she asked, awestruck. The officer looked down at her. "I am," he replied. "My name is Spock." He put a hand on her shoulder and asked with a sort of infinitely calm kindness, "What is yours?" She blinked.
"I'm Sarah," she said.
On the roof of one of the buildings flanking the alley, Valeris ran behind Raoul Duke, listening with intense interest as the journalist dictated at a furious machine-gun pace into a portable recorder. "An ordinary man would have collapsed by now," Duke was saying, his cigarette holder jagging up and down with the motions of his jaw. "But this is no ordinary man. He can't quit, because in a situation like this there's no quit in him. The replicated swine who destroyed his life is within his grasp, and he's not going to let go, not even if hanging on kills him. That's what it is to be Griffin today."
"Dr. Duke," Valeris asked suddenly.
"What?" Duke replied, jumping the gap between two buildings and then crouching at the edge of the roof and leaning out for a better view of the brawl raging in the alley below. Valeris followed, settled next to him, and then asked,
"How did you know he would be here?"
Duke looked back over his shoulder with a what-the-hell-are-you-jabbering-about look on his face, sweat glistening on his forehead despite the cold night air, and she explained, "When we left Earth, Captain Hutchins had not yet arrived on Missouri, much less Seleucia. Yet you knew this would be the place to intercept him. How?" Duke grinned, his teeth glinting in the glow of the streetlights below. "Because this is where he had to be. The answers he needs are here." "I don't understand. This planet is the beating heart of this galaxy's civilization. A wanted man would have to be crazy to come here." "Exactly," Duke said triumphantly. "In times like this, the crazy thing is the only sane thing to do. When danger is all around, the smart bastard dives straight into the vortex." Even burdened with his heavy ether cam, Edison Carter kept up with Duke, running across the rooftops on the opposite side of the alley. Keeping up with Duke wasn't his goal. He neither knew nor cared that his print colleague was even over there. He was bent on only one thing, getting his camera lens trained back on Griffin and his doppelganger as quickly as possible. "One more," Theora Jones's voice said in his ear as she guided him via satellite. "Mind the gap," she cautioned as he leaped across the last building-to-building space. "There. They're at ground level in the alley to your left." Edison went to the edge of the roof, aimed his camera down, and focused. "I see them. Ready for feed. Returning from analysis in 5. Grissom entered the alley again just in time to see Griffin lose the second phase of his fight with HN1. Triox or no, Dedian or no, he was still only human, and with the Butcher freshly energized by his kill, his strength and speed were far superior. Griffin skidded to a halt a few feet from the wreckage of Sarah's shelter, flat on his back, gasping in pain.
"Ha ha ha!" the Butcher exulted. "Who's next?"
He smiled cheerfully at Grissom as the Mountie knelt next to Griffin, pressing a field dressing to the upwelling wound where HN1's blade had been driven into his shoulder and withdrawn.
"You, sir!"
HN1 declared expansively, wiping his knife and sticking it in his belt.
"Perhaps you would like to try your luck against the infamous Butcher of Musashi? As a Seleucian, you may stand a better chance than this poor meat sack, though if you're not of the Imperial line, I shouldn't put money on it if I were you." "You're not, are you? It's so hard to tell nowadays, bastardy being the Seleucian national sport and all."
Grissom raised an eyebrow, almost Vulcan-style. "So you admit that you're the Butcher of Musashi?" Up above, Edison zoomed in on HN1's face, almost holding his breath with anticipation, and he was not disappointed when the android replied,
"Admit it! Hell with pride!"
The Butcher threw his head back and laughed long and loud.
"It was a thing of beauty. One of the little bastards even grabbed my leg. I did him first. Whammo! Ha 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 ha! An electromag packs quite a punch up close. Not clean like a phaser. I hate phasers. I like a big mess. Especially now that my age has caught up with me. I've developed quite a taste for blood."
Griffin dragged his protesting body to the corner where Sarah's shelter had stood and pulled himself up to a sitting position against the wall.
"Genom made you,"
he said through pain-gritted teeth.
"Of course.
To frame me and destroy morale."
"Well, they didn't send me to play Santa Claus at the Christmas party, lover boy."
"Just keep rolling. Just keep rolling," Theora repeated in Edison's ear like a mantra. The Butcher's eyes misted over with twisted nostalgia.
"Ah, those were the days. You should have seen the look on your face when I ran past you in the hallway. Ha ha ha, what a rube. Never even figured it out. And the look on the bitch's face when I took a shot at her. You know I let her live on purpose. I hoped maybe she'd do the job right and off you when you came around the corner, but just like a woman, she bungled the job. Still, I got the satisfaction of knowing that she's suffered every day since. You know I bet she hasn't slept a full night's sleep in 92 years. On some level, she must know what a dope she is. Really, how could she mistake me for you all those years?"
He shook his head in mock sadness.
"What a dull-witted bint. Hot, yes, but really."
Griffin pulled himself a little more upright.
"Shut up," he snarled.
Grissom straightened, unfastening the flap of the cylindrical holster he wore at his right hip.
We can still end this peacefully, he said. There's no need for us to descend to bloodshed.
What do you think we've all been doing so far tonight, officer? Playing fucking racquetball? The butcher sneered.
Up on the roof, Valeris realized that the Seleucian officer, though brave, couldn't possibly stand a chance against a monster like the synthetic assassin he faced. With the captain wounded, the Enterprise group maintaining a defensive position out on the street, and the others still battling the Genom troopers in the park, with the surprise unable to maneuver in these tightly packed warrens. She looked in wide-eyed surprise at Raoul Duke as she suddenly understood the last thing he had said to her.
Straight into the vortex, she said quietly.
Huh? Duke said, but by then she had mounted the combing at the edge of the roof and jumped into space.
I don't want to draw my weapon, Grissom told HN1 calmly. If you let the situation escalate that far, it can only end poorly.
The butcher's face went red, his mood suddenly switching from mocking exultation to rage.
Bring it, fur-face, he snarled. I'll take your popgun away from you and fuck you with it.
What? A black and gold blur dropped out of the sky above him and landed on his shoulders like 20 hundredweight of bricks, bearing him straight down to the ground. Valeris felt the impact jar through her whole body, pain raising a haze before her vision as a bone in her left leg, bonded after the crash of the Invincible but not fully healed, parted again. Falling clear, she half-rolled, half-stumbled to her feet. Teeth gritted, fighting her still disordered mind to muster the concentration necessary, she summoned up all the close combat skills she knew and limped in to press the attack. Nearly HN1's equal in strength, Valeris was an experienced hand-to-hand combatant in her own right. In addition to her Starfleet self-defense training and a smattering of the ancient Vulcan art of Sus Mana, she had at her disposal all the dirty tricks and painful surprises a person learns in 10 years behind the bars of a military stockade, a stockade where prisoners incarcerated for treason are not particularly well-liked by those who are merely murderers and rapists. She wasn't at her best, though, even allowing for the broken leg. She did not regret what had happened to her at the psychic hands of Raoul Duke. She felt more free, more alive than she ever had in her life, but she did find it difficult to concentrate, and against a foe like the Butcher, concentration was critical. Before long, she found herself slammed up against a cinder block wall, her toes barely touching the ground, with one of the android's forearms jammed under her chin. Sneering, the Butcher leaned close to her, watching her face go slowly olive.
You're no good to me, HN1 hissed. All that copper. Feh. Still, you're a pretty thing, aren't you? Such a symmetrical face. Kissable, even. I'll be nice and leave it so they can have an open casket. Do Vulcans do caskets?
Valeris replied. The Butcher looked intrigued. What? He asked, relaxing the pressure on her throat slightly.
I couldn't quite make that out, dear.
Valeris stared straight into his remaining eye as he noticed that her pupils weren't quite the same size. She smiled as sweetly as a person in her situation could smile.
I have your knife, she said.
HN1 recoiled, roaring in pain, as she jammed his survival knife into the middle of his body with all her failing strength, then broke it off.
Gah! Vulcan whore! The replicant bellowed, smashing her against the wall again. You think you'll stop me? I've had so much worse. I may look like you, meat sack, and I may bleed, but I'm a superior being.
He stepped back, letting her crumple to the ground.
I was built to kill and programmed to love it. And I do. I did from the very first day.
He threw his head back, eyes shut, as if overcome by the memories.
Oh, God. It was beautiful. All those kids, and they all thought I was Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, Rambo, and Carrie Eurodyne rolled into one. And then, whack! Oh, my God, the memories alone keep me warm at night. Thank you, Largo, for an eidetic memory.
He roared into the sky, his arms thrown wide.
It was so glorious! All the blood, the brains, the young lives snuffed out. I'm writing a book. I'm going to Disneyland. I want the movie rights!
Grissom had heard enough. His hand went to his belt again, preparing to draw, but before he could do so, there was a metallic scrape behind him, and a burly brown-coated figure pushed past him, striding as if unwounded toward the ranting replicant. "Hey," said Griffin. The butcher stopped yelling, turned to face the revivified Earthman with a look of shock. "Shut the fuck up," Griffin went on, and before HN1 could make any kind of response, Griffin hit him in the face with the chunk of rebar that had been holding up one corner of Sarah's shelter. The butcher staggered, and Griffin, finding that that first hit had felt pretty good, hit him again, and again, and again. Within three blows, HN1 had ceased trying to fight back at all, and it was no longer a fight. It was a deeply aggrieved man, sunk far down in a fugue of fury, administering a good old-fashioned trade union beatdown, pounding his foe into a broken, blood-soaked heap and singing, "I've been working on the railroad," under his breath, as he swung the redneck katana over and over. Eventually, he raised the bar, and it wouldn't come down. Surprised out of his reverie, he looked back over his shoulder and saw that Gil Grissom had stepped up and taken hold of the weapon a foot or so above his hands. "Benjamin," he said quietly, "he's had enough." "I don't think I have," Griffin replied. Grissom didn't let go. "I think Her Majesty would be just as happy if her knight commander didn't turn out to be a murderer after all." Griffin stared at him, furious. How could the man call this murder? And then turned his attention back to his huddled, quivering nemesis, coughing up blood on the grimy pavement, and had to admit he had a point. He relaxed his arms. Grissom let go of the rebar, and Griffin first lowered it, then let it fall to the ground at his feet with a clang. "Well," he told the butcher, "they won't have any trouble telling us apart now."
"Go fuck yourself,"
HN1 gasped. Griffin took a step back, then got a hopping start and kicked his android double unconscious. Then, resettling his coat upon his shoulders with a jerk on the lapels, he turned to Grissom, said, "He's all yours, Inspector," and crossed to help Valeris to her feet. "Are you okay?"
"I will recover," the Vulcan replied. "Besides," she added, leaning on his shoulder, "you should see the other guy."
Above, Edison finished shooting the Mountie, arresting what was left of the butcher, then delivered a terse wrap-up from the field before throwing back to the studio for further analysis.
"Great job, Edison," Theora told him. "I think that was easily the story of the year."
"And we were the only network in sight," Edison replied with an easy grin as he straightened up, hefting the camera's familiar weight. He looked around, his grin fading slightly.
"Theora?"
"Yes?"
"How do I get off this roof?"
Griffin walked slowly out of the alley, delivered Valeris silently into the hands of Dr. McCoy, who needed the distraction to temper his utter dumbfoundedness at the day he was having, and then turned to regard the little group of people standing out on the sidewalk with him. Jim Kirk and the rest of the Enterprise crew eyed him warily, as did Zoner. The Sterling twins and Scott Bernard, who had come along with them, were smiling, but seemed a little on edge because of the Starfleet people's wariness. Off in the background, Spock was handing over his small charge, who seemed at this distance a bit reluctant to leave the Vulcan, to a very upright Mountie woman with the shoulder boards of a superintendent. As Griffin stood and regarded this group, his own landing party arrived, running up the street and falling in behind him with their weapons ready. For a few moments, the two groups stared at each other, a tense feeling of potentially imminent conflict in the air. Griffin turned, giving his shipmates a tired smile. Savick nodded, raising a hand, and put away her phaser. After a moment, Vanessa and Jamie complied, the latter slinging her rifle with a look of reluctance. Savick unhitched Griffin's katana, which she had recovered in the park and put back in its abandoned saya, from her shoulder and handed it to him. Turning back to the Starfleet contingent, Griffin took a slow, easy step toward Kirk, then another, holding his sword casually in one hand by the scabbard. The Enterprise security officers tensed, ready to intervene if he attacked their captain, but he raised his hand in turn, signaling them to back off as he stepped out of their line to meet the fugitive.
"Captain Kirk," said Griffin. "We haven't been properly introduced. Captain Benjamin D. Hutchins, USS Invincible. Thanks for your help back in the park."
Kirk inclined his head graciously.
"You're welcome, Captain."
Perhaps you can clear up some confusion for me. We know your ship and crew come from a parallel universe, but are you, in fact, the same man who was once executive officer of the Wedge Defense Force starship Wayward Sun in this one?
I had that honor for nearly 300 years, Griffin replied.
Then you must know you're a wanted man.
I do know that. I understand the Federation has assigned the Musashi matter to Starfleet for adjudication.
Kirk glanced back at Spock, who was just rejoining the line. The Vulcan nodded confirmation.
In that case, Griffin went on, then in the interest of galactic justice, Captain Kirk, he proffered his sheathed sword to the younger man. I surrender myself to your custody, sir.
Kirk took the weapon, regarded it appreciatively. He wasn't a swordsman himself, but he knew quality when he held it, and then smiled and handed it back.
You may keep your sword, Captain, he replied, then added wryly, I won't have it said that James T. Kirk treated a fellow starship captain like a common criminal. I'll have to hold you on board Enterprise until we can make arrangements for trial, but if you'll give me your parole, as one officer to another, you won't be confined to quarters.
You have it, Captain, and thank you, Griffin said. Whatever he planned to say next was preempted by the sudden appearance of a Crown City Constabulary official vehicle, which pulled up in the street next to them and disgorged a trio of people. Two of them were uniformed officers, who immediately drew their weapons and moved into a mutually supportive arrest formation, while the third was a tall, thin, graying man in a severely cut suit.
I want those women arrested at once! The Minister for Home Defense shouted, pointing an accusing finger at Savick and the rest of the surprise landing party. Along with the maniacs on that ship when you catch them. They're responsible for massive aerospace violations, carrying unlicensed weapons, and...
He paused, scowling with annoyance when his portable comm sounded, but then his face went blank with surprise as he recognized the ringtone. Pulling out the device, he flipped it open and said, Hello? Stiffening to something like attention, he said in a much more civil tone,
Yes, Your Majesty.
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Very good, Your Majesty.
Moving the phone away from his head, the minister covered the mouthpiece with one hand and said to the taller of the two CCC officers, Sergeant, Her Majesty the Queen wishes to speak with you.
Evincing bafflement even through the visor of his riot helmet, the CCC sergeant holstered his weapon, took the phone, flipped up his visor, and answered, Hello?
A pause while he listened intently. Then he nodded firmly, though the Queen could not see him, and said, Of course, Your Majesty. I'll see to it immediately. Closing the telephone, he returned it to its owner, and while the minister was putting it away, he drew his weapon again and said, Minister, you're under arrest.
What?
The minister blurted. The sergeant nodded to his colleague, who put her weapon away, handcuffed the minister, and ushered him into the back of their car. Turning to Savick, the sergeant gave a slight bow and said, You and your colleagues are free to go, ma'am. Her Majesty the Queen bids you welcome to the Empire, and she would find it most agreeable if you would all visit the palace at your earliest convenience, though you'll have to fly there as it appears that someone has destroyed the bridge. Savick received this last comment with the gravity its deadpan delivery deserved, inclining her head precisely 5 degrees.
Thank you, Sergeant. We shall certainly call upon her at our first convenience.
The sergeant closed his visor over his responding smile, saluted, climbed back into the car, and drove away, leaving Kirk and Griffin standing there giving each other identical, What just happened? Looks. Griffin recovered first. Captain, may I have a moment with my first officer? Then I'm at your disposal.
By all means.
Griffin turned to Savick and handed his sword to her, saying, Take the surprise back and pick up the rest of the crew. I think we can safely presume that Azrael's invitation applies to everybody. She nodded, tucking the weapon under her arm.
And then?
He shrugged. Beats me. I guess we'll figure that out after the trial, assuming I'm not in Takran Galtos.
I will be there, Savick promised, then raised her hand in the Vulcan salute and said in her native language, Until I see you again, live long and prosper.
Griffin returned the salute and replied, Peace and long life, my...
Blast. Vulcan has no terms of endearment.
Off to the side, Valeris gave an explosive giggle,
causing Dr. McCoy to pause in tending her leg and give her a puzzled look. Spock only raised an eyebrow. "It's a barbarous torturing of grammar, sir," Vanessa put in, "since it involves using an adjective as a noun, but if I may suggest, my indispensable."
"Oh, well played, Lieutenant," said Griffin with a grin. "Extra grog for you tonight. Tell Hunter I said so."
Bowing to his first officer, he kissed her hand, then turned and said, "I'm all yours, Captain Kirk."
"Ooh, me too," said Valeris.
"Damn it, girl, stop trying to get up or I'll saw this leg off," McCoy grumbled.